Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Did you watch the Oscars?
No.
Some of it.
What have you all, as a group, been talking about since that day?
I think it was awesome that Samuel Jackson finally got his first Oscar. I think that his work has been amazing and that he should have got it way ahead of this time, but I'm happy that he finally got it. As well as Will Smith, another black man having the Best Actor award.
The deaf actor winning the first award for a deaf actor. That was really memorable for me.
I've just been seeing a recent controversy regarding Will and Chris and why they said the things they said, why Will reacted the way he reacted. Chris is a comedian. He makes jokes. Will, there was no telling how anyone would have reacted to someone talking about their wife. He could have taken that probably behind closed doors. But that's just my opinion.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. We're going to talk about Hollywood tonight. This time last week, as I said goodbye on our show, I could not have imagined that I was about to spend the next week consuming and joining, if I'm honest, joining debates about Will Smith slapping Chris Rock in the mouth on live television. But that is surely what happened. And the thing is, stepping back from the smack itself, this now feels like a defining trait of the Academy Awards. The whole event is like a screen upon which we project cultural debates that go way beyond the art of filmmaking. And maybe it was always so. I mean, the event is ultimately a publicity campaign for Hollywood. Which is why tonight we're going to explore questions that the slap heard round the world raised for Hollywood itself. Will Smith, after all, is one of the industry's biggest stars, maybe one of the biggest ever. And my first guest has been thinking for a while about why that's the case and what it says about the industry and about the rest of us. Soraya McDonald is the senior culture critic for Anscape. Her writing on pop culture, fashion, the arts, and literature made her a 2020 finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Criticism. And before the slap, she wrote an essay titled, "Does It Matter If Will Smith Is Actually the Best?" Soraya, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me again, Kai. It's a pleasure.
Well, we have to talk about the slap itself. It's still being litigated a week later. It's become the platform for a debate about violence, about who stands up for black women, about celebrity impunity, even about who has
racial
the right to
racial
essentialism, who has the right to have an opinion about any of this is part of the debate.
Yes.
One thing, though, that everybody seems to agree upon is that Summer of Soul had its moment taken from it. And I guess that is almost the most ironic to me, that this film that was like this beautiful film about a concert that was meant to heal a community that had just been through like violent times.
Exactly. Bringing people together.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think, in part because Summer of Soul is so celebratory of the healing aspects of art and what it can do, how it can really be a balm for people. And, you know, if there are a group of people, you know, who can appreciate that, it's Black people, it's us, right? And, you know, the other thing that I think is really quite amazing about that is, you know, it's not just that you have Questlove, who is this prolific artist who has been turning out like just all kinds of fantastic hip hop for years and years, you know, but who is also an excellent band leader. And, you know, as we find out, an excellent documentary filmmaker, to the point that with his first feature project, he is competing against one of the big deans of documentary filmmaking in Stanley Nelson and wins. That is an amazing moment.
Yeah.
And it really is a shame that we didn't get to sort of bask in that in the way that we could have. You know, the other thing I think that's worth mentioning is that this year's documentary category, period, was just really, really stacked, right? You have the animated film Flea, you have Attica, that's Stanley Nelson's film, Summer of Soul, you've got Ascension, which is, you know, this really interesting sort of look at the way capitalism and consumer culture influences labor in China, you know, where so much of the stuff that we buy gets made. There's so many interesting conversations we could be having if we didn't still have to be talking about the slap.
About the slap. Well, one of the things I have to say, I mean, you know, so Joseph Patel, who was one of Summer of Soul's producers, he has been vocal about feeling like this moment was stolen from them. And he's focused on Chris Rock's joke as he presented the award that it was Questlove and four white guys. And setting aside that it was actually only three producers.
One of whom is Asian.
Patel is South Asian. And he felt really erased in this moment.
Yeah.
And I guess I wanted to ask you to comment on that. But more than that, I also, it just sort of made me wonder, think about the ways in which the ceremony has become this kind of strange diversity competition almost.
Oh, gosh.
So I guess it sounds like I've touched a nerve there. What is your reaction to that?
You know, I think one of the things that really sort of irritated me about this particular Oscars was it was very clear, you know, I think in the acceptance speeches, but more in the presenter speeches, right? We keep coming to this lauding of, oh, we have so much diversity. We have so much diversity. You know, it is a drumbeat. And I want to say, rather than talk about it, just be about it. Just nominate good work, right? Make sure that you actually see the amazing work that Black people and people of color are doing, right? That queer people are doing. And recognize that for more than just, you know, here is a Black person who has done something, or here is an Asian person who has done something, or here's a queer person or a deaf person. But, you know, I think it would be nice to talk about and appreciate the artistry of what these different folks have accomplished. You know, if we go back to 2016, you know, with the Moonlight La La Land debacle, Moonlight is, gosh, one of the, I think in the history of the Oscars, it's like one of the lowest budget films ever to win Best Picture. It was made, I think, for like $3 million.
Yeah.
It's this incredibly beautiful, heartfelt film. You have this excellent score, all these different things. And then what we end up talking about is the accounting error that leads to this catastrophe when Best Picture is announced.
The Academy Award.
Which is, in case people don't remember, is when the announcer
La La Land
announced that La La Land had won, but in fact, Moonlight had won.
I'm sorry. No, there's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Yes. I will say that, you know, the Oscars, the Board of Governors, has absolutely like tried to make strides, like since getting sort of pinged repeatedly, first with the Oscar So White hashtag that was created by April Rain. You know, so this is an organization that realizes that it has egg on its face that way. And one of the ways that it, particularly under the stewardship of Don Hudson, has tried to correct that has been by trying to achieve some sort of like parity when it comes to who they're inviting as new members into the Academy to vote in these various categories, right? Now, the problem is that overall, this is an institution that's so white and so overwhelmingly male that it's going to take more than a few years at the rate that they are going before the demographics of the Academy more accurately reflect the demographics of the country.
I mean, I wonder if hearing that, if because the other way to look at all of this is like, maybe it's a good thing, you know? Maybe the spectacle that happens every year around the Oscars and all of the fraught debates that come out of it, like, they kind of reflect society, you know? I mean, that, a lot of what you just described, that's society right now.
Absolutely. You know, and I think for a long time, we had two American live televised events that we rely on, frankly, even if we don't necessarily realize it, to do this, the Oscars and the Super Bowl. Mm. You know, consider, let's say, Beyonce's performance at the Super Bowl when she does Formation and all of the dancers are dressed up like Black Panthers. Okay, ladies, now let's get in formation. And this is when, you know, Beyonce basically, even though if you've listened to her, you know, from the moment her career began, like, she's obviously someone whose artistry and whose voice is steeped in this sort of Black history, right? Like, right. You can hear the Motown influences, you know, you can see the single white Michael Jackson glove in the Bootylicious video, I think. and yet for a not insignificant number of people, that performance was when they realized, oh, Beyonce is Black.
She's, you know, Black, like, she's into Black things.
She's into Black things. She cares about civil rights. Who knew? To the point that there's a Saturday Night Live sketch that essentially makes this point, right?
Yeah.
Those two telecasts for a long time have really shaped how the American public thinks about itself. And it also is reflective of the conversations that we are trying to work through, right? Like, that is why Whitney Houston's 1991 singing of the national anthem at the Super Bowl ends up being about so much more. Right? Mm-hmm. It's about the Gulf War. It's about patriotism. It is about who gets to set a stake and proclaim, I am American. And what does that mean? What does that look like? All of those things are wrapped up in these moments.
I'm talking with Soraya McDonald, senior culture critic for Anscape, about the spectacle of the Oscars and the seemingly annual ritual of funneling our cultural debates and our anxieties through this awards ceremony. Coming up, we'll talk about Will Smith himself. Way before the slap, Soraya was asking us all to consider the cultural complexities of his role as Hollywood's most popular leading man. Stay with us.
Hey, everyone. This is Kusha. I'm a producer. You've been sending us so many thoughtful messages in response to our episode a couple weeks ago about the complicated relationship between our names and our racial and ethnic identities. If you haven't caught that episode, please do check it out. It's titled How Bic Became Beth, and it aired March 21st. One message we received has got us thinking about the next segment we could do on the topic. Take a listen.
Hi, Kai. This is Lauren from Inwood, Manhattan. I found one aspect of the conversation that wasn't touched was the impression that the name leaves in combination with voice. I'm a Black woman, and I have found that in white settings, I feel the need to prove that the person who has been talking with those people, either over the phone or in writing, using the name Lauren, is the person that they are now speaking to in person with my Blackness, with my locks. It's an added burden to sort of verify my identity yet again. My name and the way that I speak might put me in a different caste, but as soon as I'm seen, I go back down and then have to reprove myself. Anyway, thank you for the show. It was great. Bye.
Thanks, Lauren. And to everyone listening, does this sound familiar to you? The way your voice impacts the way you're perceived? If so, send us a voice message about your own experience. You can email us your messages to anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, that's anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and we're talking about Hollywood this week. Later in the show, author Jeff Yang will introduce us to what he calls the defiantly Asian future of cinema. Right now, I'm still joined by Soraya McDonald, senior culture critic at Antscape. We're reflecting on the slap heard round the world. And Soraya, the part that you have wanted to talk about in all of this is the Will Smith of it all. You were writing a good deal about him specifically before this event, and the way you see him is almost an avatar for Hollywood in general.
Yes, in a lot of ways.
So tell me about that. Say more about what about him, even before we got to this slap, was it makes him such an avatar for Hollywood.
So, you know, as I was working on this essay that published before the Oscars aired, and the headline is, "Does it matter if Will Smith is actually the best?" As I was working on a draft, the sort of working title that I had in my head was Will Smith, Hollywood Man. Hmm. Because, as you say, he's such an avatar for the industry and for institutionalism in a lot of ways, right? Like, there's this moment, and I want to say it's the first Men in Black, where, you know, he has, if you have not watched this film, it's so much fun. It's a wonderful, just sort of like,
I mean, who hasn't watched it?
Lighthearted 90s blockbuster in which Will Smith, you know, joins this like secret galaxy cop agency called the Men in Black, right? And, you know, one of the things that sort of contributes to the iconography of that film is the suit that he's wearing. But, you know, he looks like a G-man, right? Like, that's basically what that suit is. And when he puts it on, right, on his black body, what does he say? He says, "Oh, I make this look good.
I make this look good."
Mm-hmm.
He makes institutionalism look good, doesn't he?
Wow.
Until Sunday.
Up until Sunday. Wow. And so you think that's a big part of his appeal, is that he's affirming, his roles are affirming of sort of these, particularly law enforcement institutions in our society.
Yes, they very much are. You know, because he is a person, you know, really that Hollywood can point to and say, see, you know, it's not just that he has a career, but that he has this stretch where he is ubiquitous in the world.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows who this man is. Everyone is going to see his movies. He is the one who sort of breaks through this fallacy that films that are led by Black people don't do well internationally. And these are not sort of small projects, you know, that folks have to fight for years and years to get made. He is a creature of the studio system.
And you say this as a fan of him, though, right?
I do, yes. Yes, you know, because the thing is like, none of this would work if he wasn't good at his job, right? If there wasn't something about him that kept us returning over and over again to watch him on screen. He has a very easy, sort of pleasurable screen presence, right? He's funny. He knows how to use his body, particularly for comedy, but he's also very suave. He's non-threatening. You know, when I spoke to Washington Post columnist Alyssa Rosenberg, who wrote this really sort of sweeping project about the history of policing in Hollywood and the way these two industries kind of work together, with the result being what we now sort of recognize, something called copaganda. But one of the things that Alyssa mentioned when I spoke to her about that piece is the way that policing on screen has functioned for a long time as a what she calls a citizenship machine. Mm-hmm. And basically what she means by that is that, like, if white people can trust you to carry a gun, you're a citizen in America.
Wow.
So this idea that, like, that is the ultimate trust that we can sort of bestow and put in someone who is non-white, is we trust you with this deadly weapon. And that becomes like this really significant part of Will Smith's career, because he does those roles over and over and over again, just in a variety of contexts, which is why it's so disturbing because in a way we're sort of witnessing this breaking of the fourth wall, because this isn't movie violence, right? This isn't pretend. What we saw Sunday was real.
Right. From this person who had been deemed the safe Black person. And
exactly.
Now suddenly he's not safe. I hadn't thought about it that way, Sarai. You've also compared him as an actor to previous big and other big Black leading men unfavorably. Okay, so that's my characterizing of it. But you've said it's a notable comparison when you think about someone like Denzel Washington and Sidney Poitier, for instance. But put him in context of those two men who I would say are probably the two names that come to mind when you think of like massive Hollywood Black men stars.
You know, and what's interesting about that is that if I could be Doctor Who and go back like way early in Will Smith's career to when he does 6 Degrees of Separation, where he's basically running a scam and pretending to be the son of Sidney Poitier in that movie, I would say, go do more roles like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do the blockbuster stuff, of course, but just make sure that you've got, you know, one or two of these every year where you're sort of challenging yourself and pushing yourself in ways that are sort of weird and uncomfortable, because that's how you're going to grow as an artist. And so when I compare him to Denzel, you know, or to Sidney, that's part of what I'm saying, right? Because that feels like the piece that is kind of missing from Will's career. Kind of the last time I think that Will Smith really threw himself into a serious role where he is absolutely challenged. But I think where he also rises to meet that moment is the 2001 film Ali, which was directed by Michael Mann. I mean, I absolutely think that performance was worthy of a Best Actor award. Unfortunately, he gets undone by Denzel Washington, because that is the year that Denzel wins for Training Day. And the interesting thing about that, right, is that Denzel, he's following in the footsteps of Sidney Poitier in terms of his career, in terms of the sort of rigor that he puts into it, his sort of dedication to going back to theater, to kind of buttress his skills, his sort of dedication to rehearsal, all of those kind of like things that can get boring and rote, but that will, you know, you kind of got to grind it out to make yourself a better artist. But the other thing is that Denzel trusts his audience. And that's not just Black people, right? He trusts his audience, but he also trusts himself and his talent. So he plays this utterly loathsome, horrible, corrupt narcotics cop who is basically a sociopath and who is genuinely terrifying, right? All of the sort of stereotypes of Black manhood that we find most threatening and scary and all of those things. He finds a role basically where he gets to embody all of those things and take what some might say is this huge risk, but it pays off.
Well, and it's interesting too, like from what you said about Will Smith being sort of in these roles that affirm institutionalism as a likable person, as the Black person who's allowed to carry a gun. And in that light, when I think about Training Day and Denzel taking that job, it's the exact opposite.
The opposite of that, yes. Exactly. He really takes this immense chance, because the other thing that he's doing, right, like this is not a role that makes cops look good.
No, it certainly does not affirm institutionalism.
No, by any stretch.
You also wrote about Cicely Tyson about a year ago. And
I did.
In that, you wanted to, again, talk about her career as a way to talk about the history of Hollywood in general and the ways in which we need to understand these modern debates. What were you trying to get at by looking at her career?
Well, you know, like Cicely Tyson, I think, is just a really interesting figure to think about the history of film, because she's born in December 1924 in Harlem. You know, when she actually like decides that she's going to get into show business, this is not something, you know, that her family is necessarily super supportive of. And it's easy to understand why, because, you know, like so many other areas of American society, it's deeply segregated. It's rife with, you know, bigotry and all sorts of things. But because this is a moment, basically, where the film industry is really quite young, what you're seeing with the artists of those eras is that they are basically sort of creating themselves on screen. They are creating a sort of mass media understanding of Black people on screen. And they are doing it under the strictures of something called the Hays Code, or the Production Code, as it's known, you know, which exists from, I want to say, about 1934 until 1968. And that's a good stretch of time.
Yeah.
But like, that is after, like, the Voting Rights Act, right, has been adopted. And, you know, I think most people are sort of familiar with the Production Code or the Hays Code because of the kind of self-imposed strictures and censorship that the studios come to agree to regarding sort of the portrayals of licentiousness on screen. But of course, this is something that doesn't just affect depictions of sexuality on screen, but it also puts in place these rules about how Black people can exist on screen, right? And not just how Black people can exist on screen, but how they can exist in relation to white people, how racism can or cannot be acknowledged. So the Hays Code is why, right, you don't see like miscegenation or, you know, any sort of like sexual relationship between Black and white people on screen is a big no-no during this era. And that is because, you know, you have exhibitors in the South who say, well, if you make those films, we're not going to play them in our movie theaters. And so, you know, to basically sort of preempt this, to get ahead of it, the studios say, okay, fine, we're going to come up with these guidelines for things that we can make without having to worry about our profits being cut into, because there's a whole section of the country that just won't show these films, period.
It's also why you don't see anti-Black violence in the way...
Exactly.
You know, again, thinking about sort of the Will Smith, Denzel Washington comparison, that history feels relevant.
Yes. So this is a point in the country where lynching is very much a fact of life. And yet, if you go back and you look at, you try to find lynching in, say, the studio pictures of that era, you can't. It's very difficult to find any sort of depiction of racial inequality in which white people are explicitly responsible for that violence and inequality. And that is because of the Hays Code.
Well, before we wrap up here, this was all like the Oscars are supposed to be fun. We're supposed to go to the movies and at least to some degree escape reality. So what are your parting thoughts for people having been through another Oscars where like that's not quite how it ended? How do you process this moment, Fred? Help other people process this moment.
Maybe we should all be watching the Independent Spirit Awards more. I mean, because the thing that we've seen in recent years has been this like precipitous drop in Oscar ratings. And I think that coincides with a real diminishment in the faith that Americans have overall in institutions. You know, we see that in governmental institutions, but in institutions, period. And I think that is part of the reason why the Oscars have been struggling so much and why they don't hold the same sort of cachet that they did. I think going forward, they really are going to have to, I think, wrestle with and be honest about the history of that institution and what it was built on as they think about what they want it to be going forward. I think that's the only way you're going to be able to get that audience back.
Yeah. Soraya McDonald is the senior culture critic for Anscape. Her writing about pop culture, fashion, the arts, and literature made her a 2020 finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Criticism. Soraya, thank you so much for your writing and for this conversation.
Thank you so much for your thoughtful questions, Kai. I really appreciate it.
Up next, why are some people so put out by Pixar's latest film? a coming-of-age story about a 13-year-old Chinese-Canadian girl sparked an exhausting debate in some corners of the internet. But author Jeff Yang says, get used to it, because the era of defiantly Asian film is upon us. That's next. Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. We're talking about Hollywood this week, and I'm joined next by another one of my favorite pop culture observers. Jeff Yang is co-author of Rise, A Pop History of Asian America from the 90s to Now. It's his fourth book. He's been writing about Asian American culture for 30 plus years at this point. And in March, he wrote an essay for The Guardian about the response from some corners of the white internet to the latest Pixar film, Turning Red. For Jeff, the conversation that film sparked has been instructive about the way culture in general is shifting and for the better. Jeff, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So let's start with, for those who haven't seen Turning Red, just what's the film about? Describe it for us without any spoilers.
That's a little bit of a challenge. Yes. Although I will say, even describing the movie in some ways essentializes it a little bit. It is a Pixar film, the first film, first feature-length film from Domi Shi, a Asian-Canadian animator of note who had created an earlier short film called Bao, which got a lot of acclaim and actually an Academy Award.
It's great.
It's amazing, but it showed a little bit of her unique perspective on the world, as particularly in relation to mothers and children. And this ultimately is a film about intergenerational tensions, about expectations from not just your parents, but also your peers. It's about puberty. It's about coming of age. And it kind of projects all this into the metaphor of a young girl living in Toronto, aspiring to getting tickets to that, you know, sexy new boy band. You're never not on my mind. Oh my, oh my. I'm never not by your side, your side. And in the process, finding out that her new feelings, these sort of stirrings inside herself, causes her to turn into a giant red panda. Because that happens, you know. That's just
because you're a teenager. There's a monster lurking inside.
Exactly.
Don't come in here. What's going on, honey? Are you sick?
And what, setting the haters aside for a minute, what about this film did you love? What did you love about Turning Red as a Pixar movie?
Oh, I loved so much about it. I mean, not only is it a world that so rarely, I think, gets depicted, the actual world of that sort of awkward puberty phase of young women in particular. You know, we see lots and lots of stories about coming of age from the perspective of young boys. But girls, because of the way that our society operates, the biological changes, the aspirations, the longings, right, that girls have often is taken out of the narrative. And this film is very much about that. But it's also very specific. It feels like a movie that comes from a unique place and space and time and culture. All that, to me, I think, is a gigantic blessing. It's like a gift to be able to use, you know, animation and film to see through other people's eyes. But not everyone feels that way.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, what? So you wrote this essay in response to the reaction you saw on the internet. What did you tell us about that response? What did you see in response to this film that bothered you?
Okay, so there was in particular one reviewer who put out this very kind of blanket statement about the film that he could not see himself in it, and therefore he found even just sitting through it to be exhausting. And he said, oh, there is an audience for this film. I don't think it's very large, but I'm sure those who do end up actually belonging to that tiny demographic will in fact find value in this. For me, basically, I can't see myself in it, therefore I don't want to watch it at all. Yeah. And that, in various iterations, seemed to reverberate across the ether, right? But, you know, collectively, it was this interesting notion that somehow film only works, pop culture only works, if it absolutely reflects who you are. And obviously, for some of us, we've been engaging in pop culture for a long time without necessarily having that
That's the part that I genuinely cannot, I mean, I don't mean this rhetorically, I genuinely struggle to wrap my head around. I am not 13. I am not a girl. I am not Canadian. I am not Chinese. I am none of the things in this film. And I found it intensely relatable. I have been a teenager. Like, it felt like a really quite universal story to me, actually.
Especially since the basic trope of emotions turning you into a giant monster is something that isn't just universal. It's also really familiar, right? I mean, you know, we do have a Hulk. We have several of them.
Right.
And just because this is turning red and not turning green, all of a sudden, something is not clicking with some people. I do have a theory about it, though. And that has to do with the fact that, first of all, this is an Asian lens, right? An Asian girl's lens. And I think that for some people, it is comfortable for them to exist in a space where they're consuming pop culture that's really different from them, that has aliens and, you know, people from other planes of existence, because they can then safely put that in the pocket of stuff that doesn't exist, right? Stuff that is fantastical. And then there's this world of things that look kind of just like them. And that's comfortable, because isn't it comfortable to wear your own shoes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this middle ground where you're forced to put your perspective into the shoes of kind of that uncanny valley of people who are just similar enough to you, Canadians, right? That they feel familiar, but different enough so that something about that difference sticks in your craw. That is something that they feel very uncomfortable with.
You blame Hollywood itself for training white audiences to feel that discomfort, because they've trained white viewers to understand themselves as the default, the norm. And you make an interesting point about what that in turn does to art that doesn't center white people. You write that a film that centers an Asian American experience has to, quote, either be framed as incredibly weird and alien, a cult experience offered up for cultural tourism purposes, or it has to be flattened, softened, and lightened so as to make it as digestible as possible.
That is, I think, something which not just Asians would recognize. Pretty much any popular culture created by and for people other than what you might call the prime demographic, right? Which by and large is 18 to 50 or even 18 to 34-year-old white men, ends up being tested against this spectrum of, hey, how far out can we make it to make it still interesting to this group, because they can delve into it as outsiders,
mm-hmm.
or how much can we squarely sort of smash it into a box that fits this group? And it really does create a situation where the entire industry of pop culture creation makes us feel like we belong in the lobby and not in the seats, right? And nevertheless, you know, we've always come out. I mean, Hollywood at this point is earning more money in movie ticket sales from people of color than, you know, per capita than any other groups, right? We're the ones who have pretty much supported the industry, even through the pandemic. And yet it still often feels like the very biggest movies up until very recently have been designed for people other than us. You know, we've had to actually do that hard and exhausting work, if you will, of migrating our perspectives into other faces and voices and identities. And we've gotten very good at it because, again, we've all grown up that way.
Yeah. One of the things you point out in the essay is just the premise of this being a niche market is itself absurd.
It is quite funny how women in particular are always described as a minority, right? Women, anything female is marginalized despite the fact that women are literally the majority of humans on this planet.
On the planet.
And Asians as well, right? I mean, that's something which I think even as we were going back and looking at popular culture over three whole decades for our book Rise, we started to recognize that we have our own mainstream, that there are many people who are in our world with us. And that when we start thinking about things from the perspective of not feeling like we have to kind of self-marginalize, there is a much bigger world that we occupy and that, any, frankly, we can invite other people to occupy as well.
That's, and I think to me that there is the rub, right? The decision by people of color from a variety of communities to just not self-marginalize. Yeah. There's a power shift that you're describing there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think where you see those power shifts becoming more like power coalitions, right? Opportunities for building a mass audience out of very different parts comes in spaces like hip hop, for instance, right? Or martial arts cinema. I point to those two in particular because when you look backwards at the ways that those two spaces have developed, they started as very specific emanations from a niche culture, if you will, right? From an underground somewhere or from an imported place. But then they rapidly gained following laterally across different communities. You know, hip hop was a very much a Black thing in its beginning, but it also incorporated, you know, Latinx peoples, Asian Pacific peoples, white people. And that coalition of creators created something that is now one of the most important mainstream influences on culture at large. Martial arts cinema obviously began as an Asian thing, largely. But the first people to discover it in the United States were African Americans.
Yeah.
You know, both in terms of the popular culture side of it and even the practice of it. And now, again, it's a dimension of our pop culture, which is more than broken through to the mainstream from kind of cult fancy. But the people who discovered it and who kind of built that first audience were people who were perceived to be on the margins. So it's a rethinking of the way that we consider even what a mass audience might look like.
Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, not to put too fine of a point on it, but it just, the whole thing feels like quite a metaphor for where we're at as a society at large. I mean, you know, this idea that the prime demographic has been taught to be normal, and as a consequence, you know, everybody else either has to be an alien or some kind of bland version of themselves, and that we've now refused to fill either of those roles for them anymore. And there's our society.
Absolutely. I mean, Hollywood has always been kind of a big metaphor and certainly a trailing indicator of where society has moved. I think that it's clear that even as we call out Hollywood, Hollywood is special because it has glitter around it, because it does punch above its weight in terms of its impact, simply because, when you see it on screen, it's bigger. It means something more. But a lot of these shifts have been taking place in the streets. A lot of these shifts have been taking place in interpersonal relationships. There is very much a sense that the same forcing factors that have existed in Hollywood obviously have existed throughout society, and that there are more and more groups who are willing to say, you know what? Yeah, if that's the way it's going to be, maybe I'll take my time, my money, and my butt elsewhere.
Elsewhere. Elsewhere. Okay, well, so the real point of your column was to say that the era of all this is about to be over, that Turning Red is part of a larger movement of films that will be defiantly Asian and defiantly female. So I want to talk about some of those movies that you have in mind. You mentioned Uma, for instance, right?
Uma, yeah.
Who is this woman?
That's my Uma.
That was all she had.
So in some ways, Uma is like almost the dark reflection of Turning Red. It's another movie about a mother and a daughter, and kind of an age-old story, especially among Asians, right? This trope of generational tension and kind of that neediness that exists across generations is something we've seen plenty of times. But what's different now is we're starting to see them through genres that we've never been able to speak in before, right? And actually, a lot of credit, I think, goes to Get Out, you know, which I think was, with Jordan Peele's incredible movie, was one of the first to really start using horror in a way that was explicitly not just about social issues, but about racial issues. Mm-hmm. Uma does that as well. It's also about Sandra Oh, who plays the mother in Turning Red. Mm-hmm. In this case, however, she's the daughter and she's confronting the reality that her mother, her immigrant mother, who has always felt kind of put to the side by society and by her family and by her daughter, has now passed away and is seeking to come back and is seeking to sort of, you know, have a family reunion that involves coming back from the dead, right? Which is never as pleasant.
It's never a great idea.
awkward Thanksgiving. But yeah. But if you were to actually watch these two side by side, you'd say, oh my gosh, there is definitely a conversation going on between these two. And I don't know that we've ever really had a situation where two movies by Asian, you know, North American directors with largely Asian casts have been able to be placed side by side this way. Mm. And they're both enjoyable and they're both kind of cool, you know.
What about, you also mentioned Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yes.
Tell us about that film and why it's notable to you.
Well, it's another mother-daughter story. Except this one stars Michelle Yeoh, and it is this exceptionally weird, exceptionally brilliant piece of martial arts multiverse fantasy.
Across the multiverse.
In which Michelle Yeoh plays a woman, an immigrant woman, who realizes relatively late in her life that she actually is the nexus of worlds.
What's happening?
She has this ability to connect to all these other selves that could have been her had she made different choices. You know, the multiverse is all about branching paths. And if she had just made, you know, different decisions in her life, she would have potentially been a silver screen superstar. Or a singing sensation, or a sign spinner, or or an ass kicker, and all these things end up becoming opportunities for her to not just change the world and save the universe, but rebuild her relationship with her daughter. And again, it's another story that feels familiar enough for us to find hooks in it. Not just if we're Asian, but I think people of all backgrounds, but has this exceptionally different perspective. And in this particular case, stretches the idea across literally an entire cosmos. Honestly, it's one of my favorite films, not just of this year, but maybe of all time.
Wow. So what shifted, Jeff, if this is a new moment, right? And you're able to list all these films that are in conversation with each other. What brought this moment about?
So I have to tell that story both from the lens of the work we did for the book, for Rise, but also from a little bit of a personal perspective. I mean, obviously, I've been documenting, writing about Asian and Asian American popular culture now for 30-odd years and seen a lot, right? But those 30 years have been important, not just for me, but for our community and our world, right? In the sense that, going back into history, 1965 was when America itself changed. It shook on its own firmament. Prior to that, people coming from Asia broadly were part of an excluded zone where immigration was very limited, only a few hundred people per year. And then in 1965, this act called the Hart-Celler Act basically opened up the threshold of America for Asian immigration. So virtually all of our parents, and in some cases at this point, grandparents, who came over in the 60s, came over because of that one bill. And America went from having just a few million Asian Americans to now over, like, I think it's verging on 20-odd million, right? So these last three decades have really been this time in which Asian Americans have really been forced to fill in this empty box we've been checking off all this time, right? You know, even as a kid back in the 70s, I had to actually check off this box Asian without knowing what it meant. But these last three decades, we've started to figure out what that meant. Wow. And on a personal level, I mean, just over the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've seen a complete seismic shift, if you will, in Hollywood. And part of that is something which I was witness to firsthand. That's because my son, Hudson Yang, was cast in this television show called Fresh Off the Boat.
I love food, Dad.
I love food too, son. I love food too. You're following in my footsteps.
Indeed.
This is on the TV side of things, but it was ABC's decision to really lean into quote-unquote diversity, right, on prime time. And so they created this show Fresh Off the Boat, they created Black-ish, they created Cristela, a number of different shows that were intended to expand the audience in primetime to another set of new worlds of family, right? And Fresh Off the Boat was a hit. And over the course of those 7 years, a lot of the people who were associated with the show as performers or as writers, et cetera, they went off to other places as well and started to create entirely new things. Ali Wong was a writer for that show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Constance Wu went on to star in Crazy Rich Asians, right?
Yeah. I don't really know what they're... I haven't met them yet. I'm going to meet them tonight. I'm going to...
Gigantic blockbuster coming out of nowhere, romantic comedy.
You're going to Nick's grandma's house wearing this, wearing that.
All Asian cast. And I think that the conversation I had after the pilot of that show, Fresh Off the Boat, when they had this sort of big party, invited a bunch of people from different studios, I met a white studio executive who said something to me that blew my mind. We're just standing by the punch bowl, and he leaned over and said, you know, we're really excited about this show. It looks phenomenal. We feel like if it is successful, you know, we have so many projects we'd love to make featuring Asians. Mm. And this will finally be the moment we can do that. And it struck me, the reason why Hollywood is the way Hollywood is, everybody's expecting somebody else to put that toe in the water and to succeed right before anything else can change, right? So it's not ever been from a dearth of talent or even a dearth of ideas. It's always been a dearth of opportunity. And in this particular case, finally getting to that point where talent and opportunity connected with ideas has unleashed a transformation of Hollywood itself.
Jeff Yang is co-author of Rise, A Pop History of Asian America from the 90s to Now. We'll put a link to his Guardian essay about the film Turning Red in the show notes for this episode. Jeff, introduce us to your dog. Your dog joined us for the conversation. We gotta.
That's my Asian American dog, a Shiba Inu, named Aiko. Yes.
Aiko, nice to meet you too, Aiko. Jeff and Aiko, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Sound designed by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Froman, and Kusha Navadar. And I am Kai Wright. Keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And, of course, find me live next Sunday evening, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.